Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is author Claire Hennessy. And I began by talking to her about In the Movie of Her Life, which is her debut short story collection for adults. Claire, this was great.
Oh, thank you.
I flew through it. Do you know what I really liked? And I was saying to someone about this morning, is that, you know, I've read lots of short stories and lots of collections where, you know, lots of very deep and difficult and exposing things you've dealt with, but you're so funny.
Thank you. It's really lovely to hear that. And, you know, because I think humour is such a personal thing. And I think as well, sometimes if it's humour about something sort of quite dark, people can, you know, have very different responses to it. You know, can be like, no, that's not kind of a laughing matter. I think there is something lovely about kind of the Irish psyche that we lean into the gallows humour, you know, because otherwise, how could we cope?
Yeah, no, 100%. And there's some great kind of, you've got great first lines as well.
Thank you for noticing that. I feel special. I've been reflecting on kind of the first lines for my own Substack newsletter, blog, yoke, whatever you want to call it. And it was the first time I'd actually looked at the collection since, you know, doing that kind of final stage of like, you know, kind of going like, oh, how did that comma get in there? Oh, where did that comma go? You know, the really kind of tiny things where you absolutely cannot see the stories anymore. It's all tiny sort of formatting matters. And then I was kind of revisiting kind of the first lines and kind of go, oh, I like some of these actually. I think these are quite good. And obviously, you know, Irish lady, I'm always wary, you know, about that sort of, God, I'm having self-esteem now. I better not have too much of it. You know, can't be having too much of it because the notions police will be onto you. It'll be all terrible. I think as well, like, they are often the things that you work on. You work on, not necessarily the hardest, you work on the whole thing. But like, I think getting that sort of first line can be a really, it can be your way in to a story. Whereas I think with last lines, I know I'm not alone in this from working with, you know, a lot of other writers, but with the last lines, we've kind of got a tendency to sort of like make our point and then make it again in slightly different language. And just in case you didn't pick up on that, I'm just going to say it again. And, you know, it is the literary equivalent of kind of getting out sort of like a big hammer and going like, listen, I am hitting you over the head with this. Just in case you didn't get it, I'm just going to go one more time.
But your endings are quite sort of oblique in a nice way, I think. Well, not obviously all the stories are. That's the other thing is all the stories here are very different. And yet there's a kind of a content, the voice, like even though the voice changes and everything changes from story to story and even from almost genre to genre, there's a Claire Hennessy throughout all of it, you know.
Thank you.
Which is, that's a hard thing to do, I think, to have that kind of constant, I don't know, I know that I'm reading it, you know what I mean, even though I think maybe it is humor. But yeah, what you're saying about endings there, Jessica Traynor was talking about a kind of bumpiness when you end a poem sometimes, rather than just like a smooth landing where you kind of go ta-da. If there's a little kind of hump like that, there's often that kind of sort of, yeah, not bumpiness, but a kind of a surprise or eyebrow raise. Or I love your endings as well as your beginnings. One of the best first lines, it was a story called Heat Wave, and we'll get to your book choices in a minute. Sorry, everyone who's listening, going, where are the book choices? Sorry, I've just finished reading this. I finished reading this book last night, so I'm all kind of, it's a story called Heat Wave, and the first line is, it was the summer of the heat wave when I decided I would break up a marriage. And you're just like, you know, that's why I read it so fast. I flew through these stories. They're all so kind of weirdly relatable, even if you're not in that period of life yourself, which I'm definitely not in my 20s. But but you know, there was so much of it that you kind of going, I'm very vulnerable. Before I ramble on, I'm doing all the rambling here. I was reading your interview there with Sophie Grenham at the weekend, and I loved it. I loved that interview. And I didn't know that, and I'm going to say this, and you're probably going to do it, you were a gifted child.
Yeah, it's really exciting being almost 40, and that's still coming up. I think a lot of people sort of think that that is kind of far more kind of maybe notioncy and sort of and special than it is. So, I mean, I've worked in kind of a part-time in that sort of area of extracurricular gifted education for nearly 20 years now, which is kind of bonkers. I think like really what you're talking about there is, if you've got like say a classroom full of 20 people, right? Now imagine that you had a class that small, right? Okay, we know that that's absurd, but you have a class of say 20. You're talking about one of those in every classroom. You're talking about kind of like sort of the top kind of 5% or what in that kind of educational setting is referred to as the 95th percentile, but based on sort of various kind of tests and kind of ways of kind of assessing. And obviously it's a lot more complicated than that, and there's other factors, and there's not everybody kind of tests well, so there's a whole lot of kind of other stuff around that other people other than myself are far more qualified to kind of to talk about. But I think one of the things that really strikes me is that I started writing young, I started publishing young, and people kind of sometimes look at you and go, well, that's quite extraordinary. And I don't think it is, because every single summer I am encountering both kind of directly, maybe sort of, sort of 20 people, but then maybe sort of, 300 or 400 or 500 overall, who are all, sort of like passionately sort of working on things that they kind of care about, and achieving things, and just and committing themselves to incredible kind of projects. So it's not that special, really, is what I would say.
Well, I suppose why I'm asking you that, because I was reading about that and I'm thinking, okay, so I know that you were writing at that age, but like, when did you start reading? Were you like in the true sense of the word precocious in that sense? Was it earlier than normal, or do you remember coming to language or words?
I remember always being a reader. And I do know mainly from relatives telling me the stories. And I think a lot of writers have kind of similar stories of this kind where, somebody's kind of reading to you at bedtime, and not everybody has that. It's a thing that every child should have, but not all of them do. You can tell that I am like a child of the internet, because I'm going to go, right, okay, so here's a point now, and I'm just going to say 10 other qualifying things just so that you understand that I am aware of the world.
Yes. Claire Hennessy, child of privilege, was read to you as a child, but we don't all have that opportunity. Yeah, how could she?
We don't, and
Yeah.
that's one, actually, it's a weird one in the field of kind of child literature and of kind of literacy, because actually we want all kids to have
Of
that
course.
experience, and certainly in a country that is it is wealthy, even if most of us don't seem to see that wealth ever, that we really kind of should have that. And I mean, there's lovely kind of programs being done, like Children's Books Ireland have this amazing like book gifting thing where it's like making sure that children have books from birth. So it's a whole thing, right? So back to, the epic privilege of sometimes being read to by a relative,
Yeah.
as a small child, mainly to shut you up and get you off to sleep. But I was definitely that child who, and again, many writers have had similar experiences, or people who work with books, where you become kind of a little monster and you're like, no, you skipped a page, you didn't say that right. That's not the way it ends. Or like, look, just give it to me, I'll read it myself. So I wasn't the best at being kind of read to. So I was always, I think, a voracious reader. I was not always reading the kind of books that the adults approved of, particularly my primary school teachers, who were very distressed to have, like, again, I mean, what a strange complaint. Yes, Claire reads a lot, but she's reading a little too much of, like maybe like American series fiction, and we really feel like she should be reading classics in which maybe talking animals could express like sort of a moral to the child, or maybe there could be like sort of like a wise kind of old sort of like maybe grandmother or grandfather or elderly neighbor who could impart wisdom. I am interested because I'm still kind of in that world. I review young adult fiction for the Irish Times, and I'm kind of constantly thinking about that tension between the books that the adults really want the young people to be reading, and then the books that the young people want to read themselves. And I think you really, there are sometimes differences, and there are sometimes overlaps as well, you know.
Do books still get passed around like illicit contraband, like the way they did when, like, probably they don't anymore? You know, just on that point, we would all have
Oh, the
been
copy of
passing
Duty
around.
Blooms Forever that falls open at certain pages.
Yeah.
How, I mean, goodness, how innocent we
I
were.
know.
And I mean, you have the internet, so you don't need to do that. You're instead, finding the equivalent on Wattpad, and you're sending a friend a message with the link, you know. Is now, I think that's how it works, but like, do keep in mind that, I'm just kind of like, oh God, I'm trying to sound like I know what the young people are up to, and I have only the vaguest kind of notions about it.
Oh my goodness. Well, have you seen Adolescence? I mean, I think after, oh yeah, have you not seen it yet? Okay. Yeah, yeah.
No, I thought I'd just, sort of read the 10 million think pieces about it
You may, yeah, you
before
feel like
going
you
into
have.
it.
It does make passing Judy Bloom around feel somewhat, idyllic, really. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. I know the UK are talking about having that, like sort of showing that in schools, and it's kind of like, is that the
I
wisest?
think as soon as you make it prescribed, children are going to laugh at it, really, aren't they? As soon as you make it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And like teachers, I mean, like the idea that sort of like, teachers who are dealing with so many other things and so many kind of difficulties are suddenly kind of immediately equipped, or might do kind of like a morning of a Zoom training, in order to kind of to have discussions about that in a meaningful way. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to sort of to like, you're always an outsider if you are an adult in a room full of teenagers. I think there are sometimes people who kind of think that they're one of the kids, and it's like, no, you're not, and you're not supposed to be. And because at some point there might be something where you have to kind of be sort of like in loco parentis. You have to kind of be very, very kind of sensible. I'm always really conscious as well that, like, anytime I'm sort of working with young people, like, sort of, I just become incredibly sort of sensible. And then if it's like, if you're writing for them, if you're writing about them, it's like, oh yeah, throw in all the inappropriate things. That's fine. I mean, they're very kind of different roles.
Back to your own childhood here, though, Claire, and you talked about flying through series and American series, but you also, what I know from, like, knowing, quotation marks online, that you're a big fan of, like, Clary series and Mallory Towers and all the kind of boarding school books. Was that big for you as a kid, as a little girl?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, very much so. I mean, you're putting that in the past tense, and I mean, I have reread those books as adults, and there's kind of a process that you need to go through with those as well, with the rereading as an adult,
Tell me.
because there is the sort of awkward kind of like, are these books as good as I remember? Are they as well written as I remember? No, they're not. So there is kind of that little sort of like kind of cringe moment, and then you kind of, and like, I think particularly you're also kind of maybe attuned to, are there details in Blighton that would absolutely not hold up today? And it's like, yes, absolutely. But there's also, and then sort of, you kind of, you power through that, and you move on, and then you get to the point of sort of going, okay, but what is it about these books that does kind of appeal to young readers? And I mean, some of it is that there can sometimes be a kind of a little bit of kind of preachiness in Blighton's work. I mean, she was an educator. That was kind of her training. You can kind of sort of look at that and go, oh, that's actually sort of quite didactic. But actually, if you're a young person, you quite like feeling a little bit superior to certain characters, you kind of like going, yes, she was a naughty boy, or no, God, my goodness, I've just done a thing there
You've
that I don't think
reinvented
Blighton would
Blighton for
approve of at all.
2025.
Oh my God, that was probably more about the Famous Five and George. Okay.
Yeah, I get you though, but that sense of, but the sense of boundaries or the sense of kind of order, but yeah, like, I'm feeling part of that, like, yeah, they took so and so's midnight feast, so
The
you know.
Midnight Feasts are amazing, and like, I think there's a very interesting, there's a very interesting distinction between adults who like, grew up reading books like those and really wanted to go to boarding school, and adults who have actually been to boarding school,
Yes.
and they will just laugh at you. You'll be like, but all the midnight feasts and playing the tricks on the
Yeah.
mistresses, and that wonderful sort of lovely lovely, lovely kind of bonding. And I mean, I mean, and there's like she's known for kind of other books as well. You know, so you have, you know, your famous five, and you have the secret seven, you have the five find outers, and you have the, you know, the faraway tree. And I mean, all of those are kind of great. But like the school stories are, I mean, and they're just as fantastical in their own way, you know. But they feel as though you can have interesting stories in quite sort of ordinary places. You know, you can have interesting stories can happen like in a school. And I think that's very appealing to like, you know, to kind of a young person who like you might kind of otherwise kind of think, well, I'm now, you know, if I'm writing something, if I'm kind of creating kind of my own work of any kind, it has to be, you know, it has to be sort of like, I don't know, something really kind of fantastical. You know, there has to be like a prophecy, or there has to be, you know, there has to be sort of like a series of kind of, you know, magical objects that I need to track down, or, you know, I need to like go through a portal. You know, I need to be kind of entering sort of this kind of fantastical world. And I mean, and all of those books, wonderful, 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 and that whole field. But I think also really kind of helpful to be like, okay, you can actually get kind of quite interesting and kind of dramatic kind of situations from just the quite ordinary things. You know, like not getting on a sports team, or I mean, I say that as though like, you know, I've ever been, you know, not my area, you know. And particularly I would go for, even though I love the St. Clair's books, I would go for the Mallory Towers over St. Clair's, because you've actual character continuity, right? Again, love Blighton, but can see her sort of quite clearly. At her most prolific, she wrote something like 10,000 words a day, which is kind of
Same.
insane,
Yeah,
insane, and
it
yet kind of
is.
admirable.
Yeah.
And part of how she did that was kind of, you know, sort of like taking familiar kind of, you know, things she'd kind of already written and going, okay, we're just going to tweak it kind of slightly.
Yeah.
But like with Mallory Towers, you have a strong central character in a way that you don't really with the St. Clair's, where you kind of start off with kind of the twins, and then they kind of fade into focus, and you get Carlotta and Claudine, who are, you know, automatically more interesting because they're not British.
Oh, Claudine, that's just
Which
sparked a memory. Claudine at St. Clair's, yeah.
she was mischievous, but you know, and she was French, but eventually she learned how to have that good, correct sense of schoolgirl honor. And which is kind of this interesting mix of like the ethics of these books are kind of fascinating, right? Because it's, you know, there's that thing of like, and you see it kind of a little bit as well in the naughtiest girl in the school, you know, where it's like, okay, what it, like how do kind of groups of young people police each other? And at what point is it kind of okay or kind of desirable to get sort of an adult involved? And at what point is it just telling tales? And
Timeless.
that's sort of interesting. And if you're telling
Yeah.
tales, and then you'll be shunned, you know, and you'll have only yourself to blame. But then it might all be a misunderstanding, and actually everything might be okay. And you know, sticking by people, and kind of demonstrating your loyalty is very, very important. So yeah, it's fascinating from
Yeah, I'm
that
just
point of
thinking of
view.
different titles for those books, like Nobody Likes the Grass by Enid Blyton wouldn't have quite sold. But bringing you on to your own adolescence then. So I mean, I get a picture of you as a sort of a primary school child, just reading voraciously and just like into everything and just like, you know, alive with all of that. But often when people make that transition into secondary school, there's a change in them. You know, I've seen it in my own daughter, I've seen it in friends' kids, that there is, you go from, honestly, like it can be like from night to day or day to night, it can be that sort of dramatic. Did that happen to you? And did it happen to you with reading? Or how was that whole thing for you?
It didn't really, and I think that was because I was writing and I was not one of the cool kids. So, you know, and I think that can sort of be a big thing as well, that you know, that kind of peer pressure, and like sort of the sense of like what are the acceptable activities to be doing, what are the unacceptable activities to be doing, you know. So yeah, I mean, it was still something that I absolutely, yeah, I pursued, and it was sort of important to me. I would say probably more so a thing that I kind of found maybe sort of towards maybe kind of leaving cert, and then sort of like into college, where you're reading so much for kind of exam purposes that your leisure reading gets impacted. And I mean, I think like, you know, when I talk to young people kind of now, and sort of, you know, talk to them about kind of reading, you know, the response is kind of like, I don't have the time. And it's not necessarily actually that they don't have the time It's that reading a book becomes associated with that kind of, reading for study, reading for analysis. Sometimes the kind of the torturous thing of like, there's a class novel and, you're reading through it very slowly and you're reading it aloud because the teacher is aware that half the people in the room are not going to actually read it at home, even though they've been told to. So you kind of go through that in that sort of very kind of painful way. And then you analyze kind of everything. You assume that everything the author did is incredibly intentional. I mean, it's like, well, what the author intended here. And I just, I always kind of find that sort of hilarious because it's, and if you can question this, it's like, no, they were, this person was a genius. And it's like, if you read interviews with kind of, contemporary sort of writers, you're very aware that some of the stuff, it's maybe sort of, at a subconscious level, or it's maybe something that, maybe wasn't intentional, but then they kind of saw it and they sort of thought, okay, I'm going to kind of polish this up. But at other times they're kind of going like, no, it's just
Yeah,
this. It's
the
there
sky
isn't.
was blue.
Yeah, the sky. Well, the sky was blue, you see. And what blue actually means here in this context, because we found this like footnote from something from the same year, blue was actually sort of, the color of the year, according to that. So, a lot of that stuff kind of happening, and it makes people sound very clever, and it also gives people to it gives people something, that they can write kind of in an exam, because it is always easier to kind of go with the accepted kind of wisdom and show that you've taken that on board. I think that sort of like leisure reading sometimes kind of, gets split off, and it can be, you can just be doing so much kind of reading of material that you're going to have to analyze or kind of, think about kind of in some way. So, when you do have kind of that spare time, it's, you want something that doesn't feel like that. You want something that feels kind of very, very different.
Whenever you kind of jumped then from, and we were flying through secondary school, we've just been through secondary school, you've just done your leaving cert, whoosh, okay, that's
My
gone.
God, my God! It just flew by, flew
You
by
flew by,
altogether. We
barely noticed.
skipped the nightmares about the exams.
But when you got, and I know you went to Trinity to do, was it English with something else or English
So I
and,
did English Lit with history,
oh wow.
which is like, let's pick the thing that has the most reading ever. And I wanted to do English with another subject, because if you did pure English, you had to do, at the time there was the courses that you had to do just sounded quite hard. And there was a lot of stuff about, say, like Old English and kind of, like Beowulf
Chaucer and
and
Beowulf,
Chaucer. Well, I did have to do, couldn't escape Chaucer, but did escape kind of Beowulf, and it just seemed, I think, maybe sort of more on kind of the language side versus the kind of the literary side. So I wanted something else, and I thought, ooh, history, which I really loved, actually. I think that sort of, if you haven't studied it up to a certain point, I think a lot of people sort of, they kind of feel like they've survived the junior cert, and then they're like, right, do none of that again. It's just all about memorizing dates. And actually, you kind of realize, my God, like, no, the historians, like, do not, they're not great on dates. What they are great on is analyzing kind of texts and thinking about how people of the past felt and how they might have kind of, conceived of certain things and thought about certain things. And that's actually like really fascinating. I don't think that we kind of talk enough about that. Is such a that's a very cliched thing of somebody of my generation to say. It's like, I don't think we talk enough about this problem. It's like, actually, probably people do
I do
talk about it
that.
all the time, just you're in your bubble. But I think that, like, for me, I think that like a really interesting thing about history is that I think it's a brilliant preparation or training for creative writing, which is interesting because, so there's a line that the late great Hilary Mantel has in some piece for the LRB, and she says, "For historians, creative writers provide a kind of pornography." It's like, okay, right? That's kind of a statement. And she was speaking very much about kind of historical fiction. But like, I think that sort of way of thinking about like how our kind of position in kind of history and kind of culture and society and all of that, and kind of imagining how people would have responded to certain things, like not knowing kind of, what was to come. Do you know, not like, we might kind of think now with the benefit of hindsight that things kind of seem kind of, sort of quite kind of inevitable, it's like when, sometimes you get very badly handled in historical fiction where it's, say somebody at the start of the First World War and everybody's going, oh, it'll be over before Christmas. And there's somebody going, no, I think it's in fact going to last 4 years. And it's like, okay, that might be a bit much,
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it invites you to kind of just, to empathize with kind of people in very, very different circumstances, which is really what, and to look carefully at sort of like what the evidence kind of suggests, somebody writing in kind of a diary, somebody publishing something, somebody kind of sending a letter, who were they, who were they sort of aiming this at? What might they kind of hope to achieve? What are the limitations
I
of
suppose, yeah, I suppose, and like what motivation as well,
Absolutely.
like political or and the personal, what
And the
motivates.
personal, yeah, I think as well, like sort of very often, I think people kind of depends on sort of, generations and like sort of how kind of schooling has changed. But I mean, there is that sort of like, there's like the great man kind of sort of, pattern of history, which is kind of like, things are sort of, happen because of like, like sort of a few kind of particular kind of, actors. And actually, sort of when you get into kind of the discipline of it, it's there's a lot more sort of like, okay, but like what else was going on and like what was kind of, contributing to this. And if you were kind of like if you were sort of like a regular person in this particular sort of fraught, historical kind of moment, like how would you actually be conceiving of it? And are you there going like, oh my goodness, isn't it great that, this politician and this politician and this politician is doing this? Or are you mostly concerned as many of us are with the like everyday survival, really, really kind of
Well, yeah, I can see
enjoy
how
that.
that, yeah.
I have not been paid to promote the study of history
So,
as
folks,
discipline.
if
I'm
you'd like
just
to
kind of
take up
a
the
nerd.
history program, but the fees are reasonable. And yeah, so I'm interested why, because I have not read this book, and you chose it as one of your books from college years. But I read about it, and I was like, oh, I like the sound of this, and it's Wonder Boys,
Wonder Boys by Michael
yeah.
Chabon. I absolutely love it. I reread it last year, I think. And it's one of those books that I first read as I think I was maybe in my late teens or early 20s. And so it kind of imprinted on me. And it's also it was also made into a movie with Michael Douglas and Robert Downey Jr. and Frances McDormand and like a whole bunch of sort of like really kind of fabulous kind of actors. And there is, I mean, I love it for kind of, I think, what are quite obvious reasons, right? Which is that it's a campus novel and it's about writers and it's about sort of like one particular kind of chaotic weekend in the life of Professor Grady Tripp, who has, his novel is incredibly overdue. He doesn't have writer's block, which would be a cliche. He has a different problem, which is that he's written, I think he's on, something like page 2000 and something of the manuscript, and it's a big sprawling yoke, and he's only about a third of the way through. And he hasn't been making, he's kind of lost the kind of the plot of it. He hasn't been making kind of any kind of like choices with it. And there's a great line. Embarrassingly, I can't remember if it's in the book or if it's just the movie. Because again, both are kind of seared into my brain, but there is kind of a thing where one of the characters said, you always say, Grady, that the thing about sort of writing is it's about making choices, and it doesn't seem as though you've made any choices here. And it's like, ooh, that's a really good line. Take note, use in creative writing workshops. But it's very it's wry and it's beautifully kind of observed. And I don't think, I mean, Michael Chabon is, I mean, he's probably best known for a lot of things. The Incredible Adventures of Cavalier and Clay is kind of is one of the biggies. I think he's fascinating as a writer because he's literary, but he's also very much intent on taking sort of what we might think of kind of as very kind of typical maybe sort of I don't know lesser kind of say like genres, right? So like sort of crime or science fiction or fantasy whatever, and taking these and kind of weaving them into what are very literary kind of novels, but are also very much sort of like respecting the genre, which I think is very and he will talk about sort of like these things in very serious ways, right? Which is I think a departure from what you sometimes get with literary writers where their work kind of is spoken of as transcending the genre, you know, and it's like it's not transcending the genre. You're just not familiar with, you're not enough, you're not sufficiently familiar with it. You're maybe basing it on this very kind of narrow kind of idea of what this particular thing is, you know. And also you're maybe not realizing that every single genre has, you know, sort of has particular kind of, you know, tropes and has kind of, you know, certain kind of things, and that they have to because it's really kind of satisfying, you know. I mean, people will sort of go like, oh, you know, my God, it's like it's a romance novel, so it's so predictable because like they end up together at the end, you know. And you don't really get people sort of going like, oh no, I cannot go to another Shakespeare tragedy because they're all going to end up dead. You know, it's like that's the plot is not the whole reason you're reading it, and also what people do within the structure that, you know, that kind of structure and the kind of expectations that people have, how they both use and subvert those expectations. You know, and you can absolutely point to, and you can point to any genre and kind of go, oh, how predictable, you know. Oh my goodness, you know, there's, you know, it's a crime novel. I could not believe that there was a dead body in the first chapter of this crime novel. It's like, of course there was, you know, like what do you what? Because essentially what you're doing, what you're saying is like, I can't believe something happened in this story, a form which is about things happening. So I think Michael Chabon is a really interesting writer. He was also, this is kind of the coolest thing I think, is that like, so you know, very kind of fancy literary writer. He also he worked as the showrunner on the Star Trek Picard series, the first season of that, which just kind of had me going like, oh, I'm going out of my mind here. Do you know, you're bringing back Jean-Luc Picard, and that's very exciting. And then you're bringing in this incredibly fancy, nerdy, wonderful writer, really big fan of his. And I mean, I don't think necessarily that Wonder Boys is, I don't know if it's his best work. I don't think it's his most ambitious work, I would say. I think other books of his are more ambitious, and they have won kind of fancier prizes, but it is the one that I think is, it is just the closest to my heart. It says really kind of brilliant things about writing and about that sort of kind of insanity of devoting your life to story. It's just kind of it's very kind of pleasing.
I mean, yeah, there is something really satisfying, isn't there, about reading about the writing milieu, and especially if there's a little, you know, you recognize people in it, you recognize the different types. There is something kind of quite pleasing in that, isn't it? It's like Yellow Face, or like there's a short story recently about Rosemary Jenkinson has written a collection. Yeah, and I can't. I have to read the end of it. I have to read the end of it. It's called,
Me
was
too.
it All About Erin? And we've all met that person in the writing circles, and I was like, oh my God, like, yeah, I love reading stuff like that. But I think we all kind of,
I think we do.
yeah.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, there is kind of, I think sometimes people get kind of a little bit kind of sniffy and go like, oh my goodness, like these writers writing about, you know, other
About
writers.
writing,
That feels
yeah.
very, it feels very kind of you know, narcissistic and self-absorbed. And it's like, but there is kind of a, and you know, and certainly like there's some truth to that, right? Like there's certain kind of, you know, occasionally sort of, you know, you do kind of come across kind of certain writers, and it's like, wow, all of none of these characters, you know, seem to have kind of like jobs, you know, and like they all, and it's also like I think it's very often like sort of, you know, they also all seem to be writers at the same level as you, fancy writer person, you know. I, you know, and it's like, and you kind of want that sort of that representative thing of like sort of, you know, a couple of people who are, you know, sort of fancy and probably not as fancy as we imagine. And then, you know, sort of like a whole bunch of people who are kind of there going like, I'm going to be, you know, I have this, you know, I don't know, you know, I'm so glad that this story sold because now I don't need to choose between food and rent, you know. There's a lot of that.
But we were talking there a bit about genres and about pigeonholing books and about pigeonholing writers. And you have a book here, and I have to say, I've only read her most recent one, but I have never read this book, which was sort of an international bestseller, and it's by the one and only Marion Keyes. But
Yeah.
you chose this book, and I'm interested in why you, because you were you chose this book that you read at a tricky point in your life, Claire.
Absolutely. Well, so I am, I mean, this is no surprise to anybody that knows me. I'm constantly flinging Marion Keyes novels at people who have not read them. And people have, and you know, usually people have heard of them, and that, you know, they do that very dismissive thing. I think she is probably actually one of the writers that people now understand that they have to take her seriously, because
Yes.
there have been kind of conversations about it. And you know, at a certain point, when you're using the term kind of fluffy for work that deals with that so frequently deals with kind of with mental health issues, but also just a variety of kind of other sort of, you know, very, very kind of, you know, difficult things to deal with, you kind of have to stop using that label. It makes you seem silly, and it makes you seem kind of ignorant. So I'm very glad that we're there. And I think that there's a few kind of, I think, sort of like women writers like that who, you know, who maybe, and maybe sort of, you know, for marketing reasons, you know, certain kind of covers have been put on their books. And it's very much the thing of like, you know, woman has written book about sort of, you know, sort of like breakup of a marriage, it's chick lit. Man has done it, it is like a serious exploration of the human condition.
Yeah, 100%.
And isn't he very brave? Isn't he so brave?
Yeah.
It's so
Yeah.
brave.
I know.
It's so brave that he has, you know, written about sort of, you know, feelings. And we're going to presume that he can, you know, he can do it sort of better than anybody else. And really, I suppose I wanted to pick at least one Marion Keyes novel, because they're books that I keep coming back to at different points. And I was kind of thinking about just this morning, kind of like why I kind of gone for that one, beyond, I think, the fact that it's one that a lot of people would point to as the kind of, that was the one that just really got me, because it lures you in. It's like, it is very much like, oh, okay, yeah, no, this is lovely, this is kind of delightful. And it's like, ha, we're just gonna hit you with some really kind of incredible sort of emotional and psychological kind of insight. But I think the reason why I went for this one was because that typically, like in every kind of Keyes novel, you get somebody who is hurting, who is in pain. Sometimes it might be, you know, sometimes it's very much an external thing. It's to do with maybe sort of a very difficult kind of life situation. Other times it might be something maybe sort of that is not made easier by life situation. So it might be a particular, you know, sort of like mental health issue. And in Rachel's Holiday, so many of the characters that we see are in pain. There's so many of them. And I think part of the sort of the journey kind of for them is kind of that thing of not, you know, kind of realizing their pain is not unique, but it is real. It is to be taken seriously, which feels, I think, like a slightly different, it's a slightly different kind of milieu, if you like, to maybe sort of like the one person going through the tough time, and maybe sort of people don't necessarily kind of understand it or get it, even though she has written books of that kind that I think handle that really well. In The Mystery of Mercy Close, which looks at Rachel's difficult younger sister Helen, there's kind of a thing where it's like the kind of the variety of things that people kind of will say to somebody who is experiencing a bout of clinical depression. It's very funny and it's very true.
Can I guess? Is it go out for a walk, or have you tried running? Is it have you tried
It's
yoga? Is it
that
your
variety of
all that kind of
things.
stuff? Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, and it's but like, you know, it goes into sort of more details, like the different kind of takes on that. You know, like, you know, have you tried the really kind of basic obvious things, and then have you thought about kind of pulling yourself together,
Oh
which
yeah, I think how
obviously
lucky you
nobody
are. Plenty
has.
of horse in you.
Exactly,
Yeah,
think
that.
about how many people love you, you know, and all these things, which may be true, but I
Of
think are
course.
failing to kind of to understand that, you know, that it is, you know, I think mental health conditions can be very, very tricky for people who haven't been through them, which is a smaller number, I think, than many of us kind of actually realized. You know, so many people have had, you know, they might either be sort of, you know, dealing with a chronic condition, or they might have had sort of, you know, particularly, you know, sort of like intense bout of something. But comparisons, I think, are often made with sort of with physical illness as a way of trying to explain things. But I suppose, you know, the thing is, if you've got sort of a broken leg, somebody's going to come along and sort of, you know, put a cast on it. And a broken leg does not do things to your brain that makes it hard for you to let people put the cast on. Whereas, you know, if there's something wonky going on, you know, all of those things that all of those kind of really well-intentioned things that people kind of say, first of all, they're harder to do. And secondly, they're not necessarily going to be as effective as you might imagine, you know? So there's that difference between being a bit down and then maybe sort of, going for a nice run, and oh, the endorphins are kind of are going, and I think it's like, that's great. That is great for you. And, really, and I think we do need, like, I think a lot of the kind of the things that are spoken of as like good for your mental health are much more on the sort of like their preventative measures or their maintenance measures. And we've a terrible, I think, sort of like tendency to let people get into crisis mode before we sort of jump in with the help. And once people are in crisis mode, the level of help that is needed is much more serious. Not that I seem to have brought my soapbox today.
It's an important one, though, Claire. I think it really is. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're kind of I think sort of people will sort of go, oh, but we're much better talking about it these days, and it's like, well, we are to a certain extent, like there's the sort of like there's the acceptable kind of things to have wrong with you, and to recover from quickly, right? And then there's maybe sort of other things that we're less comfortable with. But also there's a lot of quite shallow engagement with this stuff. Like when you look at sort of like actual kind of like mental health kind of provision, when you look at sort of, how many beds are there? If you're kind of saying it's good to talk and then you have 18-month lists for counseling services, there's something up there. There's something kind of very up. I think also there's a kind of an inherent sort of problem in saying to people who are not necessarily in, who are kind of going through something or have something where asking for help is very, very difficult. And you're saying, okay, but it's up to you. It's that thing of like if somebody's lying on the side of the road bleeding, we understand that they're not going to be the one to call the ambulance. We understand that we need to be the person to do that. We're constantly saying to people like, don't be afraid to reach out for help, don't be afraid. And when people do, the help, it's not necessarily available, or people are sort of, turned away, or and I mean, not to get into, not like it's a weird one. Again, with just kind of like a kind of a feminist lens, right? Because there is kind of a very strange thing where, if you are a woman, you are less likely to be taken seriously by a medical professional. And they're much more likely to kind of just say, like there's a weirdness that goes on, right? Because it's that thing of like, you could go in with something sort of very physical and serious, and they'd be like, that sounds like anxiety, you go in with anxiety and they're like, oh, go for a nice walk. It's like,
Yeah, up your vitamin D, eat more
yes,
kale.
eat a nice apple mindfully.
Oh, that's the other thing. Yes, I suppose there's the Instagram pop psychology as well, where you can go on your, dare I say it, journey from, a mile, whatever mental health issue you have, to full
Your healing
enlightenment, your healing
healing
journey. Oh
journey,
my God.
absolutely. And
Yeah.
what really helps with your healing journey is if you subscribe to that influencer
Oh,
for
yeah.
$9.99 a month.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's, and I mean, I am as guilty of, as anybody else. I've kind of gone like, oh, that's a really nice, Instagram inspirational meme. Let me share it, and it might, sort of like, it might make some people feel better for kind of being a sort of a brief moment. But I think I'm quite kind of, I think kind of careful and wary about, some of the stuff that is, that's basically like, you might have, do you find it difficult to get out of bed in the mornings? You might have, you might, you, that's a sign, that's a symptom. And it's like, yeah, I think it's a symptom of living in a society where we're all, overworked and overstimulated and underpaid. And have you seen the news?
Sure, but if you just put out what you want into the universe, Claire, then everything will be fine. If you believe it
yes,
enough, if
yes,
you can believe it enough.
absolutely. Love, love, love kind of
Oh,
attraction.
goodness.
I know there's a particular thing that's like, do you know how like sort of, whatever social media thing it might be, they have an algorithm, but the universe too has an
Oh.
algorithm. And it's like, no, it doesn't. It doesn't. And actually, some of what you're saying might be kind of, kind of like kind of true, but for the wrong reason. Like that's kind of a big thing as well,
Yes.
right? The sort of the thing of like, Yes, that sort of idea of like, if you just, and you do get a lot of it in kind of, artistic, creative kind of circles, right? It's like, if you just, sort of like put out these thoughts, if you're paying attention to things will magically happen. And it's like, well, actually, no, I think what's actually going on is a cognitive process that I don't know the name for it because I am not a neuroscientist, but I do know other people have looked at this.
Yes, I think it's
But
confirmation
do,
bias, is it, or
so you're,
something like
it
that?
does mean, it's confirmation bias. Thank you. That's exactly what it is. And it's that thing of like,
Yes.
yeah, you're thinking about a thing and then you're gonna notice it more. But that's
Yeah.
not magical. That's
Yeah, no.
like you've just put on sort of you're looking at the world through a particular lens. I think the thing that I'm also kind of really aware of is that when people are going through something difficult, like people can say very clumsy, well-intentioned things, and I think, so I think kind of policing that, is maybe sort of not helpful,
Yeah.
because I think then you get into a situation where people are so terrified of saying the wrong thing that they say nothing. And that's what that means essentially is that you're maybe not reaching out to somebody in pain because you don't know what to
You don't
say.
want to, yeah, you, yeah.
And that's,
It's better
and I
to,
think,
yeah. Sorry, go on.
yeah, so it's nearly as though the world that we live in is kind of complicated and nuanced and cannot be boiled down to an Instagram meme or something that will fit on a fridge magnet.
I know,
Do you know?
or even to your podcast, but even just what we've just done there, I'm kind of going, oh no, I didn't mean that, and you're saying that, and I'm thinking, oh, that could be totally taken out of context and made to, but the fact that we're even thinking in those terms, that you're almost sort of observing what you're saying and what you're thinking as a
Yeah.
couple, do you know what I mean? That there's this kind of yourself editing constantly.
It's very it's well it, it it is very it is very dangerous. And I think actually I think there is a tendency for people to kind of take things kind of out of context and to use it to serve kind of their own agenda, whatever that might be, right? And I think it is one of the problems of our modern age, where I mean, obviously people have always done this, certainly as long as there's been print and there's been kind of kind of media. I would like sort of, I think, kind of more of a culture where we kind of, instead of kind of, sort of immediately jumping on the kind of the bandwagon, we were sort of like, actually, context, what is the context there? It's not, actually sharing things out of context maybe is not kind of helpful. Because it makes all of us stupider and it makes all of us meaner. And I
Yeah,
think that's really,
mean is a good word. Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of absolutely a problem. And I think it's, certainly for anybody that wants to write in any way, whether it's, sort of like nonfiction or fiction, you really have to shut up that inner editor. I mean, and like you always have that sort of inner editor or inner critic anyway, right? But I think if you're trying to kind of preempt sort of like every possible kind of negative response to your work, you will write nothing. You will end up with a blank page. And I do see that, some people are just, they are so afraid of what somebody might say about something, kind of like down the line. And it feels very virtuous, right? It feels like you're sort of being kind of very considerate. But what it actually means is that you're maybe kind of making that decision 500 words into like a novel, right? Of maybe like 75,000 words. And there's a time to be sort of maybe considering those things. And it's much, much closer to the end of the process, and I think like one thing that I'm really conscious of, say, like in a creative writing workshop, is that any situation where people are expected to read out loud, where they don't have a choice about it, that's immediately going to have them self-censoring. Because you're saying to, because what you are kind of saying is like, right, okay, so just like, don't worry about what comes out on the page, but then you're also going, oh, but like this group of strangers that you met 5 minutes ago, we're going to listen, we're going to be listening to that, we're going to be, that's what we're going to know about you, that you had that thought. My God, there's a freedom I think that people need, to be able to kind of play around and kind of experiment and make mistakes. I'm going to say mistakes in kind of in quote marks because I think very often they're not. It's people dressing up a difference of opinion with certain language that makes it seem as though it's a big moral issue instead of, I don't like how you handled that thing, which is very different to, you handle this thing in a particular way, therefore you're a bad person. Very, very different. And yet again, in our very sort of like quick and kind of intense and, kind of clickbaity sort of world, those things kind of, they kind of kaleidoscope and accordion, and you do end up with kind of situations where it's like I think a big one is writers who, like, a character in a novel or in a short story has said something, and then that gets quoted as it's attributed to the author. And it's like, just hold on a second there. Like, that is bonkers, And it makes you kind of question sort of like literacy as well, because like it'll be sort of like, the context might be, and then the class bully swaggered in, or then the corrupt CEO came into the room and they said the thing. And like, even on that one page, we know there's red flags all around. Like, the context kind of makes it very clear that this maybe not an okay thing to say, or it's kind of, it's a troubling thing, or it's something that's maybe, or maybe it isn't. Maybe it is just that. Maybe it is just that somebody has a different opinion on something, and that's okay. And perhaps by the end of the work of fiction, they might feel differently about that, or they might not, but they might be sort of punished for it. Like, there's all of these things, And I think, yeah, it's like, it's nuanced and it's complicated. I understand why people are afraid of, like, sharing their work. And like, I think there's, I think people are genuinely, like, I think there's a very kind of, genuine impulse, which is, I don't want to have something in my work that might kind of hurt somebody, right? I think that's it's a really sort of admirable kind of thing. But then that becomes kind of, I think, sort of it gets swallowed up by, like, oh, okay, if I sort of have this thing, is that maybe going to hurt, not so much kind of an individual that I might know, but it's maybe going to hurt, like, sort of a group of people who maybe do not need this level of kind of whatever in their life. And actually, I mean, I often think, like, I love that you think that enough people are going to read it, that that's going to make a difference,
Yeah, that's actually,
that's going to make a difference. But I think you can be so careful, and people who are looking for something to complain about are they're going to find something. They will always find something, and you cannot, you cannot keep appeasing people who are that very vocal kind of, but minority of people that are determined sort of to police everybody else, and approach everything with absolute bad faith. And as soon as you kind of turn that lens on anyone, it's like, if you sort of, kind of take a look at kind of, anybody sort of being very kind of, loud about these things, it's like, I'm sure I can find something that, that, like, sort of, that somebody could, with that sort of lens, could, kind of come to you and sort of go, oh, do you know what? Like, actually, I'm afraid you haven't adequately sort of accounted for, sort of something. It's a very complicated issue. And like, again, I think it is more, it is kind of a nuanced one, right? Because I'm also a reviewer. I'm a reader. I think a lot of people kind of shut this kind of down by sort of saying, like, oh, they're reading too much into things. And it's like, no, I approve of reading too much into things. But I think it needs to be sort of informed. I think people need to be sort of clear about, like, sort of, where they're coming from and what they're kind of attentive to, and kind of understand the kind of the field that they're working in. So again, I mean, it goes back to kind of to genre. If you have kind of, a situation where, where someone is sort of saying something, like, okay, let's say maybe kind of like, okay, we'll go back to kind of a romance novel, and it's like, oh my goodness, this romance novel is like replicating, heteronormativity, because there is a man and there's a woman and they have chemistry. And it's like, okay, I don't think really, I don't think you're understand. I don't think that's a good faith, sort of like approach. And also, I think there can be sort of, I think also people can kind of take maybe sort of like wider problems and then use that to zoom in on one particular sort of work, right? Like, an example I think about a lot is like the Bechdel test, right? Which is the, is this, it does this film or does this work, does it have two female characters who are named and they have a conversation and it's about something other than a man, right? And there's, if you were looking at one particular, say, like, work, it might it may well not pass the test, for a whole bunch of very kind of legitimate reasons, right? There's work that I love that is, it's like, yes, my God, I can't believe this work set in this all boys boarding school does not pass the test, right? But how kind of something like that is really useful is where instead of kind of going like, okay, this one particular work has failed, is you apply it to, 100 different kind of, texts, whether those are movies or whether those are books or whatever, whatever kind of it might be. And you kind of go, okay, overall, there is kind of sort of a problem here, rather than kind of going like, this one book did not have a character to represent every possible ethnic identity ever, or you only had sort of like characters who were dealing with physical disabilities that were kind of quite visible. What about kind of chronic illness that might not be? Like it's like, I'm sorry, you had like you had characters this and this, but you didn't have one that kind of ticked this box. And it's like, yeah, I mean, indeed, because to do so would be pandering. It would be, I think there's a version of this, right, that's kind of going like, therefore we should not care about, representation. It's like, well, of course we should care. And the reason we should care is to do with sort of, a kind of an awareness of the world kind of, sort of like as it is, and kind of and representing that kind of fairly. And to not kind of and to not be sort of making assumptions, and to kind of, yeah, be aware that sort of like people have a lot of stuff going on. But like it is also true that like say like in a group of maybe sort of like four people, it might be just a teeny bit neat if every single one of them, sort of has exactly kind of comp, like sort of, different kind of things. Like whereas, you might have kind of overlap of things, or you have, there's maybe kind of, certain ways in which people are kind of dealing with one particular difficult thing, and they're insulated against another difficult thing, And yeah, so it's messy and it's complicated. And I think if you're a writer, you're kind of like zooming in and out, because you're going like, okay, what is kind of the overall landscape? And what are maybe some kind of tendencies that I would like not to replicate? But then you're also kind of zooming back in, and you're looking at the individual kind of story or kind of individual novel, and you're going, well, what's going to kind of to serve this? And then zooming back out again and going like,
And actually, what you're saying there, I mean, that just it kind of encapsulates a lot of what's going on in the movie of her life, like the messy, complicated thing, the panning out, the then going really to a micro level, to the absolute microcosm of interiority, and then to kind of you do a very kind of well, sorry, this is just my take on the book, and I'm explaining your book to you, which must be wonderful
No,
to hear
I
me
love
telling you
it.
what your
I
book is
love it.
about.
It's very hard to explain it to yourself, and to other
Oh.
people, because again, it's like you've been in it.
No,
And
here's the.
also like with, I mean, also I think with kind of when you're writing something, you're like, okay, you don't want to have the obvious like, here's the sentence that explains the theme of the work. Just kind of
This
has to
book
be
is about the human condition.
there.
No, I know, but like just and also what you were saying earlier about, what did the writer intend? I don't want to try and guess what you intended, but what you said, you were talking about the Bechdel there. That's from one of my favorite stories. It's a very short story. Is that the one that the friend, the two friends, the hang on, is it At the Still Point?
At the still point, yes.
Is that, oh, I love that.
Thank you, thank you. That was so that story appeared in the, I feel so lucky for that one, because it was in the very final issue of The Moth, the literary
Was
magazine.
it? Oh, wow.
And I had been, like as with so many writers, kind of you send work out there and you're kind of like, you get the nose, and I got a response kind of quickly, and I was like, oh right, okay, well that's, draw a line under that now. I'll never get in there. And it was accepted, which was really, really lovely. And kind of just, yeah, just very like just right in under the wire. That kind of opens with the two sort of the two kind of female characters kind of,
It's always 2019 in the kitchen. So if Liz and I are in there at the same time, she often suggests a movie night. And it's just, I just love, I mean, like, and they all open, and that's such a delicate story. And I love that it talks about rupture in a friendship and regret, but also kind of acceptance as well. I don't know. Well, you can tell our listeners better than I can.
No, well, no, thank you for picking that one, because it's one that I wrote It was one that I wrote the first draft of it actually while I was on while I was on like a writer date Zoom call. You know, we'd set the timer and then like sort of, you know, cameras off, typey, and then report back at the end of it. And it just kind of, you know, kind of spilled out like that. And I was really pleased with it. And obviously there was, you know, there was kind of, you know, tweaking and fixing and all of that. But it's one that I do remember sort of the working on it and just kind of feeling like, oh, this is I've achieved a solid draft of this, which is not necessarily, you know, because a lot of the time, you know, you're kind of going, I have made a teeny bit of progress with this thing, you know, and then occasionally you just get, you know, sort of like lovely kind of rushes of things, and
Yes.
it's usually because it's something that you've been thinking about and kind of dwelling on sort of for quite a while, and that is a story that it is about. It's about like sort of, you know, living somewhere that has been, it's a little bit kind of magical realist-y or maybe kind of, you know, sci-fi-ish, where the kind of the concept is that there's been a rupture and then the place that these people are living has been fragmented into different time zones. So it's 1 year in the kitchen and that relation, you know, the relationship is kind of, is still sort of good. And then it's in, you know, it's kind of, it's earlier in some places, it's later in some places, it's the pandemic is kind of thrown in there, which is not referenced I think elsewhere in the collection, because dear God, we don't need the memories of it. And yeah, I really kind of like that idea, and there's a deeply unliterary kind of inspiration for that. So there's all the kind of thematic kind of stuff, right? And then there is, see, this is just gonna ruin my credibility as a serious literary person, but I don't think I had it anyway. Very much an episode of Star Trek Voyager,
Oh, brilliant.
where the titular spaceship is like, there's some kind of space anomaly because they're always encountering space anomalies in these TV shows, right? So it's basically different, just a different kind of, you know, sort of like time periods and kind of moving between those. And there's like barriers and there's like tech kind of stuff that they need to kind of to sort out. And that kind of sort of stayed with me. There's a YA novel by an American writer called A.S. King called I Crawled Through It. No, it's not. It's another one. It's a different one. Sorry, ignore that. It's called, oh, it's something, Still Life of a Tornado, maybe. It's something like that, right? It's one of those books anyway. It's a novel in which the teenage protagonist encounters versions of herself at different kind of times in her life. So there's like 23-year-old her, there's like 40-year-old her, and there's I think 10-year-old her.
Oh, I love that idea. Yeah.
And it's a way, it's sort of a surrealist kind of way of exploring trauma, which is kind of what A.S. King does in a lot of her novels. I always kind of point to her as kind of going like, oh, you'd think YA can't be literary. I'm just gonna give you
That's
one of these books. But I loved that kind of yeah, I love that sort of idea of like, you know, how can you sort of take, you know, these kind of, you know, interesting kind of like sci-fi or kind of surrealist kind of concepts, and like, what are the feelings involved, right? I mean, that's what I do, I think, a lot of. It's like, okay, yes, all of that, but like, what are the feelings? There is a book, not to be jumping back, but there is a book that I kind of, I think I mentioned to you, that I read when I was younger, and it's This Place Has No Atmosphere by Paula Danziger. And one of the reasons that I love that one is that it is the kind of the typical sort of girl who has, it maybe kind of has been doing a little bit too much kind of people pleasing and trying to fit into kind of the cool crowd, as opposed to being kind of her authentic self, and then moves to kind of a small town where she's kind of, you know, away from kind of all of that, and she has to really kind of discover what's kind of important to her. So like fairly kind of typical and sort of common. You know, the feelings are real, the feelings are sort of are big, you know, she's away from sort of everybody else. The new town is a colony on the moon. And it's like, ooh, okay, I like that. I like that. That's it's a different kind of element. And there's like kind of sci-fi kind of elements kind of around it, but kind of the real sort of emotional, you know, kind of content is still influenced by it, but it's not maybe what we would tend to think of with kind of a lot of maybe sort of science fiction, which is like, okay, right, like everything's like robots and aliens, and you know, how do we sort of deal like this? It's the kind of, it's the human stuff, and it's the, I think sometimes it's the how a kind of fantastical or speculative kind of lens can let you explore something in a more interesting way. Because sometimes looking at something head on can be a little, like, it can be a little bit on the nose, it can be less interesting to explore, you know, like, okay, so something like, you know, the pandemic of doom, how do you like How do you sort of write about that without making people really, really depressed or angry or, or haunted or many other things? And, is there kind of an angle? Is there, is there sort of either kind of a way of kind of doing it, but then giving us kind of completely sort of different sort of genre and kind of thrown in there, So like Catherine Ryan Howard writing 56 Days, where it's like, oh, it's lockdown. Then it's like, okay, but it's a murder. It's a murder mystery. Okay, amazing. We will sort of read that. Or Ann Patchett's Tom Lake, which is, it's kind of, it's a part of it, but it's also like, that's not the main point. It's kind of, it's sort of a device.
And you do something, well, I mean, in this collection, you do quite similar things with, angles into familiar stories and with unfamiliar stories and familiar angles. Do you know what I mean? You kind of, and again, with the kind of speculative spice in there. To a lot of it, but there's always that well, for me anyway, that kind of emotional relatability. Cassie, this one brilliant word. I could be thinking about this all morning, but the word in this is a get back to heat wave. It's a back to this story about the marriage. It's like, can you pronounce this word? There is a word in some
I can't.
obscure.
That's why I put it in the books that I wouldn't have to.
I'm not even going to try it. For the listeners, it's about five. So yeah. No, I'm not going to try it.
It's a Chilean word, and it's one of those words that, if you are kind of a sort of a language nerdy person, it's one of those words that turns up on, those lists of like sort of like words other languages have that, that English don't, but and that we really should. And some of them kind of, make it, kind of cross over, so things like Schadenfreude is a great one. There's one, I can't pronounce it, there is a Japanese word for, the art of basically piling up unread books.
Oh,
And it's like,
yes.
yes, we are familiar with that.
And the nostalgia for something that you never had. There's one of that. But
Yes.
yeah, but this one means the moment where two people want something to happen, but they don't want to initiate it.
Thank you. Yeah. Again, I'm not somebody who kind of, actually, in the original version of that story, there was a whole explanation about the narrator having seen that word on one of those lists, right? And see, this is where you need an editor, right? Lisa Frank at Dear Press worked really closely with her on this. This book is, it is in shape because of her. It exists because of her, right? But like, just so good at kind of gently kind of saying, like, Claire, you've put in a lot of these kind of explainy kind of things, or you've done that thing where it's, okay, yeah, we kind of get it, we sort of get it, and actually, I think what you are doing kind of so often on the page is exactly what I've been doing in conversation, which is, I've said this thing, but now I need to explain in 17 different ways the nuances of kind of what I meant there. And you can't be doing that in fiction. You're looking for kind of the detail, and you kind of need to trust that the reader is going to get it. And you also don't want to be including anything that is going to kind of pull them out of the particular story.
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes there's a temptation to just kind of indulge your observations. Well, I find that, you think,
There
well,
is, oh my
Cecile,
God, there is absolutely. And I think, again, like, sort of, I think I so quickly go into, like, creative writing workshop mode, where I'm sort of like, yes, I mean, there absolutely is, right? And that, but the stage at which that becomes really important is the editorial stage, okay? And that might be you working on something yourself and kind of, trying to make better. It might be, working out with sort of like, some writer peers, people maybe that you've, encountered over the years, and like, you're, happy enough to swap work and kind of give notes. It might be working with an editor. It might be working with an agent. But like, if you start worrying about that stuff at like first or early draft stage, you're gonna paralyze yourself, So, I think part of how you kind of improve and grow as a writer is, like, certainly the first draft stuff you hope gets kind of a little bit better and a little bit kind of, neater and whatever. But I think there's always going to be things that you do at an early stage, because that's part of the process. It's like, oh wow, you have like done a lot of explaining about this character's background in these kind of opening pages. And it's like, the experienced thing is not so much not doing that. The experienced thing is kind of going, yep, and I already have my little list for myself of, when I'm doing the next draft of this, I know that that's something that I need to watch out for, because I understand now what my first drafts look like, where my strengths are as a writer, and what are the bits that maybe won't need as much attention, where my weaknesses are, and we all have them. And I'm just kind of being aware that like there's going to be stuff that particularly needs to be looked at further down the road. And when I'm further down the road, I'm going to have a better sense of how to kind of to fix it as well. You know, I'm going to understand like when you're kind of smack in the middle of kind of something, and it's like say you've written kind of 2 pages, like you don't know yet which bits are going to make the most sense to leave in, you know. So you write the thing, and then you sort of look at the whole thing in that sort of in the context of all of it, and you go, okay, actually this bit needs to be, this is actually going to be shown later, so I'm going to pull that out. This bit is kind of interesting, I'm not sure about that yet. I might need to sort of, you know, that detail I might need to sort of, to hang on to. That detail I completely forgot that I wrote that and didn't make a note of it anywhere. I'm just going to cut that. That's absolutely fine. Like I always think when we're thinking about how to like improve our writing, I think it's really helpful to and useful for ourselves to distinguish between like the things that sort of are best focused on at the kind of editorial stage, you know, because otherwise I think you end up with that thing where it's like I have and most of us like are, you know, like we're busy people, like, you know, we have other things going on, you know, we're not living in a cabin on the side of a mountain, you know, sort of like with endless hours ahead of us to sort of, you know, like, you know, to waiting for the muse, you know, like it's that thing of like, okay, I've got 20 minutes, I need to write a few things, or I want to write a few things, you know, to be using that time to obsess over kind of getting it right. It's so counterproductive, and it leaves you with kind of a lot of blank pages, and that really kind of strong sense of like if like keeping everything in sort of like in potential land, right? And that's very dangerous. It's very dangerous.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I love that actually, potential land. Yeah.
Potential land
Goodness,
is
we are all guilty of that, I think.
absolutely, and like some, and sometimes we kind of know what we're doing, right? Sometimes we know what we're doing. You know, it's the kind of like, wouldn't it be lovely? We must do that someday, do you know? Wouldn't that kind of be nice? You know, but I think it's really helpful to have kind of a sense for yourself. And I mean, not to get sort of very to completely get very Mary Oliver about it, but like, what is it? What is it that you want to do with your one wild and precious life? And being okay with the fact that you're not going to do everything, you know? Like there could, for example, be a part of me going like, yeah, do you know what? Someday I'd really like to run a marathon. I could do that. And it's like, okay, first of all, I'm not sure that I could actually, if I'm realistic about it. You know, I know people who have done it, and well done to them. I am in no way taking any steps in my life in any way towards that, you know? So like, let's be kind of realistic here. You know, similarly, if you are kind of somebody that's like, oh, do you know what? I've always wanted to write a novel. You know, I'm going to write one day, and it's like, okay, well, is there anything that you are doing to move even slightly in that direction? You know, and sometimes, very occasionally, sort of people are, you know, like they might be sort of, you know, mightn't be working on it, but they're readers, you know, or they're writing maybe sort of, you know, they've written bits of poetry, or they keep a journal, or they've, you know, they've kind of done kind of something that kind of moves them kind of a little bit closer to it, right? And then there's people that are, you know, they're kind of going like, oh no, when I retire, I'm going to do that. And it's like, okay, and what have you been reading lately? It's like, oh, I don't read. It's like, okay, I don't actually think you want to, I don't think you want to write a book. I think you want a book to have, I think you just wanted to kind of go immediately from your head onto the page. Improving. These are the people that are using AI, you know, these are the people that are going like, I think Meta are actually great. These people are the problem. Yeah.
Well, we're not going to start talking about AI. No way are we going to open that box right now. God. But like,
We don't have 24
no,
hours, and
we don't.
it'll just lead to us
It'll
tearing our
have to.
hair out and
But
weeping
listen,
in.
I was going
Sorry,
to
go
say,
on.
talking about like steps and small steps and bigger steps. You have a book now. You have a collection of adult or adult. Sorry, that sounds completely wrong. A collection of adult fiction sounds like.
It's very difficult to find the right way to talk about it, right? Because if you say it's short stories for grown-ups, you do sound a little bit like a 7 and a half year old going, I'm almost 8, you know. So you don't have so much to say that if you say adult fiction, it sounds
Yeah.
a little bit filthy. And there's not, it's not that filthy. There's occasional
Oh, there
moments.
are occasional moments.
I invite you to find them.
Yes. Oh,
May
there
you
are.
pass around this book and may it fall open at certain pages, It is actually my favorite editorial note on one of the stories. I think kind of for me was like, yeah, you don't really get told that in YA was so this story, I think we
Think I
need
might.
another masturbation scene.
I think I know the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You do know the one, yeah.
Yeah.
I have been relating that as an anecdote and I have not said it anywhere on the record. So I give that to you.
Yeah.
I give that to you on
Brilliant.
this on this day because it is very tricky to sort of to know, like I think how to pitch it because in some ways it's a debut, in others it's not. There can be a benefit to labeling certain things as debuts because there's often kind of more kind of excitement around them. You do see sometimes work that say somebody who's written for a younger audience has an adult novel, but a novel for adults out, and it's labeled as a debut, and again, complicated, nuanced. There's an argument, I think, sort of like, to be made for kind of going like, okay, actually doing that is quite a, it's not taking work that they've written for younger people kind of seriously. But it is also true that from like kind of a media kind of publicity kind of perspective that there does tend to be more interest in something if it has that kind of debut kind of label, and there's also kind of it might be kind of eligible for certain things if it is kind of a first book. It is kind of interesting one. So I think we've the wording that we have for it is first shorts, I think debut short story collection and first book for adults,
Very good. Okay,
which
that's perfect. Yeah, yeah.
it's a little bit wordy, but
It's the best way of doing it, I think. Yeah.
it's a tricky one. And I think I'm also kind of very conscious that like the language that you use yourself when trying to kind of talk about something is, I mean, people are going to translate that into their own kind of
Of
shorthand, and
course.
that is outside of my
It
control.
is. You can't control it, Claire. You can't control the
You can't
controllables.
control the thing. And I mean,
Yeah.
that's always the weird thing with the book out there is that the bits that you have control over, and by the time a book comes out, you're kind of finished with them, and you can talk about it in kind of in certain ways, and you can hopefully say something interesting or intelligent occasionally, that might sort of kind of make people go, oh, this sounds kind of interesting. But you can't, for example, be following kind of every individual reader around and going like, now what I meant by this sentence was, you can't be doing that, and you can't be kind of controlling kind of how people kind of read something or what they kind of might get out of it. And also, like every time I say something like this, I do feel it's really important to remember that we can worry about a lot of this stuff, and also you can get very kind of in your own head about it, and it's like, yeah, most people are not going to read it. Do you know what I mean? Like that is a reality of it's a reality of kind of writing anything.
It's quite comforting, actually. It's quite comforting, isn't it? In a way.
It is and it isn't. Yeah, you kind of oscillate. You oscillate between kind of going like, oh, it's terrible. Nobody's, nobody in quote marks, is going to read my work. And then that's also kind of quite liberating.
Yeah, I want everyone to read it. I want nobody to read it. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And again, and that's you wanting control. And we
Of
all kind of
course.
want control of kind of, things that we sort of don't have control at, over. So yeah, it is a tricky one. And I think I think people like having a book come out, I think it can be a very stressful experience for a lot of people. And I think a thing that is really kind of worth doing is just making sure that you're still writing something, that you're writing something
Yeah.
else, because that's the thing that you control over, and that's also why you're doing it, so kind of to be focusing on that, because otherwise you can. It's very, very easy to become obsessed over the market, in
All the
quote
things that
marks.
aren't the writing, basically.
Yes,
All the things that
absolutely.
aren't the writing.
Yeah.
Claire, I'm going to ask you've chosen something to read for us to finish off with. I'm really curious to know which story that you've chosen or which part of which story you've chosen.
Sure. Well, thank you for the invitation to read, first of all. This is a story that you will actually know because it first appeared In
Oh,
Ireland.
yay.
Yes, it is. It's a piece of flash fiction. There's a few stories in this kind of collection that are very kind of short. There may be 500 words, there's 750 words, kind of, mixed in along with kind of the longer pieces. And I think if you've too much flash kind of in a row, it does kind of overwhelm you. But it's nice to have, and it's a form that I kind of really like. And I'm always very grateful to kind of places that, provide a space for it. It's lovely. So
Right.
this is called Haunted, and it is kind of something that came out of, I'm doing my kind of creative writing facilitator thing again. But I think with stories, you're kind of going like, you start off with the what if, and then you go, and then what, and then whatever. And this is, there's kind of, I think, a sort of a an kind of a, I don't know, kind of maybe cultural sort of, joke amongst a certain kind of generation, which is, not at all worrying about haunted houses. It's like, oh, the house is haunted, right? But like, there's no black mold. The landlord isn't awful. That sounds grand. That sounds absolutely grand. So with this one, I thought, okay, you're living somewhere haunted. There's a ghost. What happens when you introduce your partner to the ghost? So I'm going to read this now.
Right.
This is Haunted. Come back to mine, he says, in those last weeks before it all falls apart, his hand hovering at the hem of my skirt. I'm trying to find a polite way of saying that his flat, shared with two other lads, is a kip. Three Irish lads with Irish mammies. Brian Cox could do a whole series about the wonders living in the vicinity of their kitchen sink. How about my place? I don't know. He shuffles a bit. I've made the bed with clean sheets and everything. Yeah, but Maggie'll be there. Maggie's grand. She likes you. He grunts. Yeah, right. She does. She was asking for you the other night. Said I could do a lot worse than you. I aim for my facial expression to fall somewhere between sexy and persuasive, but he's not having it. That's not actually a compliment. From her, it is. Actually, I mimic his accent on the final word. You know what she's been through. Just because she's had a bad experience with her fella. I suck in my breath so sharply it stings. Bad experience? Seriously, are you fucking going to not all men this? Her husband, here I begin chopping out the words with my hands, beat her to death. I expect him to look ashamed, but instead he's defensive. Men, honestly. Well, that's what she called the last time I was over. I try to remember exactly when that was. It's taken him a while to get used to my ghost, although I think it was easier for him than for me. When I first moved in, I thought I was going mad. My GP put me on one of those endless HSE waiting lists to see a psychiatrist and told me to go to A&E if my hallucination told me to hurt myself. Whereas when he met her, our third date, and television has trained me well, that's when you either bring a guy home or put an end to it. He freaked out a bit and then had a drink. Maggie had advised on having something stronger than wine coolers to hand. She's like that. It's not entirely implausible she'd downplay the whole horrible murder by one's spouse thing. Fine, okay. I can skip lecturing him on acceptable ways of discussing domestic violence for now. Look, let's just go back to mine, okay? I suspect it's the next part where I flick my tongue against his ear that does the trick. And I'm stupid not to see it then, what it means that they've been having conversations without me, why avoiding her might be a better idea, how I will never be able to compete with the forever beautiful, forever unattainable Maggie. But of course, we never do as women, do we? Total idiots when it comes to love. She was too in life. Maggie, I call out when we get there, my key in the lock. We're home.
You've been listening to Claire Hennessy, whose short story collection, In the Movie of Her Life, is out now with Dera Press. See you all next time when I'll be talking with Rosemary Jenkinson. See you all then.